Contented Media presents Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. An original podcast series with Mark Hunter and Arthur Van Pelt.
Craig Wright is an Australian computer scientist at the heart of a multi-billion dollar battle to see who owns Bitcoin. Not the cryptocurrency, the brand. Wright has been trying to get himself recognized as Bitcoin's pseudonymous creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, for over 7 years, but having failed in the court of public opinion, he has recently taken his battle to bricks and mortar courts as he attempts to sue his way to being awarded ownership of the Bitcoin name and the trillion-dollar ecosystem that comes with it. Wright's supporters claim he is undoubtedly the creator of Bitcoin, while his detractors believe his claim to the Bitcoin throne to be based on nothing but a phalanx of lies and forgeries, supported and funded by a billionaire casino magnate. Throughout this series, myself and my co-host, semi-professional Craig Wright debunker Arthur Van Pelt, will take you through the incredible story of Craig Stephen Wright and his attempt to claim ownership of the financial revolution that is Bitcoin. This is not a story about Bitcoin, blockchain, or cryptocurrencies. This is a story of David versus Goliath, of the extraordinary lengths that Craig Wright is going to try and seize ownership of the Bitcoin brand, and the damage that is being done to regular people along the way. This is episode 3, London Calling. Hello and welcome to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, the podcast that does indeed lift the lid on the efforts of Mr. Craig Stephen Wright to gain acceptance as Bitcoin's creator, Satoshi Nakamoto. My name is Mark Hunter, author, blockchain writer, and podcast host, and it is my job to guide you through the morass of events, claims, counterclaims, lies, thefts, and lawsuits that all go into making up this, at times, unbelievable story. Once again, Arthur is with me to offer some expert insight and opinion as we explore this next stage in the Craig Wright saga. Arthur, are you ready to take another trip into the deep and mystical land that is Craig Wright's claim to be Satoshi?
For sure I am, Mark.
I am mercifully relieved to hear you say that. So, this episode is the first of a two-parter revolving around the 2016 signing sessions, with this episode focusing on the build-up to the events and what went on, and the second part focusing on the fallout. Before that, however, let's have a quick recap of where we are so far. In the last episode, we learned how Wright's name was splashed across the virtual front pages of Wired and Gizmodo magazines on December the 8th, 2015, as that of the mysterious and hitherto unknown creator of Bitcoin. However, the two outlets also uncovered incontrovertible evidence of tampering with regards to the information they had used to make the claims, information that was sent to them and many other journalists before them by an alleged former employee of Craig Wright. The same day, Wright's office and home were raided by federal agents in relation to a long-standing investigation over his tax affairs, which we detailed in episode 1. Wright, however, had been tipped off, and after removing several computers and other information from his home, was holed up in a Sydney apartment when the police came knocking. Instead of speaking to them, however, he escaped to the car park via the service staircase and fled to London via Manila and Hong Kong, where he had been planning to move in the new year to start a new job, a job that required him to be publicly recognised as Satoshi Nakamoto. Wright claimed for 6 years that a disgruntled employee stole a hard drive and used it to doctor the information that led to the Wired and Gizmodo doxing, before changing his mind in September 2021 and saying that it was, instead, the man who had launched a multi-billion dollar lawsuit against him 3.5 years previously, a case whose trial went to court 6 weeks later. Now, as we said, the next two episodes will focus on the 2016 signing sessions, where Wright was forced to cryptographically prove he was Satoshi Nakamoto after the Wired and Gizmodo doxings failed to convince anyone but his most ardent supporters of his supposed identity. Now, Arthur, the deal that Wright signed with Entrust in mid-2015 is pivotal to this part of the story, so why don't you remind us what that was all about?
Yeah, this was in June 2015. 15, that was the moment when, about a week earlier, Craig received a letter from the ATO that he had to pay, like, I think, $5-6 million. And he was so bankrupt at that moment that he could not pay that back. So he needed a bailout. And he found Robert McGregor, Stephen Matthews, and in the background, Calvin Ayre on his path, who were willing to help him out. He told them the stories of Satoshi, that he was Satoshi. So, yeah, they were willing to help him at that moment. And they bailed him out for a total of around $15 million. Craig received $1 million for his, what is called, his life rights, the story of his life, including a reveal as Satoshi Nakamoto.
Brilliant. Thank you. So now we've got a bit more detail regarding the rationale behind Wright's need to be identified as Satoshi. Let's look at the lead up to the signing sessions in more detail. So we're talking here about the period between late December 2015 and April 2016. Now, the reason we have so much information about this portion of the story is thanks to a man you're going to hear a lot from, Andrew O'Hagan, who we've already mentioned in this series. O'Hagan was contracted to write about the signing sessions as part of a kind of biography of Craig Wright, basing it on the assumption that he was Satoshi Nakamoto. O'Hagan says he only took the deal when his impartiality was assured, which involved not taking a fee, allowing him to be under no pressure to report Wright in a favourable light. Indeed, Robert McGregor asked Andrew O'Hagan to put together a warts and all report on the time he spent with them. Despite this, Wright has since accused O'Hagan of fabricating elements of the resultant story. The biography of Satoshi Nakamoto never saw the light of day, although O'Hagan's report on the time he spent with Wright and his backers during 2015 and 2016 did make it into a report called The Satoshi Affair, which was published by London Review of Books in June 2016 and offers a fascinating insight into Wright's experience and his shifting mindset during this time. O'Hagan first met Wright in London in November 2015, just days before the Wired and Gizmodo stories were published, a meeting at which Wright's principal financial backer, Robert McGregor, introduced Wright as the goose that lays the golden egg, which backs up the suggestion that their designs on him were purely financial. As we know, there was a deal in place that meant Wright had to be publicly revealed as Satoshi Nakamoto, or the plan would fail. The Wired and Gizmodo stories that initially doxed Wright before backtracking, thanks to almost all the evidence used in the stories being fraudulent in some way, did not dissuade the Entrust gang one bit, who were convinced of Wright's identity as Satoshi and ploughed ahead with their original plan to reveal him to the world, even though their thunder had been stolen somewhat. They had planned a multi-stage approach to proving Wright's credentials, ending with a dramatic signing session where Wright would sign early Bitcoin blocks with cryptographic keys to which only Satoshi Nakamoto had access. At this point, McGregor said, it would be game over. Andrew O'Hagan attests to their confidence when he says that the Entrust team were behaving as though the Satoshi claim was the end of the story rather than the beginning. Following the Wired and Gizmodo furore, which ended up with Wright moving to London weeks earlier than planned, he was advised by McGregor and co. not to publicly address it, which explains his silence post-reveal. However, we get an insight as to Wright's mental state at this point from Andrew O'Hagan, who paints a picture of a conflicted man during this spell between December 2015 and the proof sessions that were to come the following April. Wright spent the rest of 2015 and early 2016 settling into his new role as chief scientist at Encrypt, the subsidiary of Entrust to which Wright was contracted, and preparing for the signing sessions, which had initially included plans for a London School for Economics discussion panel and a TED talk where Wright would publicly reveal himself as Satoshi Nakamoto. As for the impact of the sessions, one man who wasn't convinced about the whole plan was Alan Pedersen, Wright's former project manager who had worked with Wright in Australia and was now working with him in London. He told O'Hagan that he thought Wright had sold his soul to the money men and that when this Satoshi thing comes out, I can see a lot of bad things happening. Pedersen was also of the mind that Wright's reluctance to be sent to stage was a complete act, saying that his wife Ramona was the one who was more concerned about any potential ramifications. He said that Wright had been pushing for this to happen, something Wright has denied since, saying he felt forced into it. Pedersen also had another very telling insight, saying that Wright was In this box, he can't move, he can't do anything, and this box is getting smaller and smaller. Arthur, we showed in the last episode how Wright was really painting himself into a corner by, as the tax office put it, lying to them about the source of the funds for his multi-million dollar tax rebates. But how much more pressure did this Encrypt deal put on him?
In one way, he will be relieved that he is not, he's able to pay back the ATO and get them off his back, at least for a while. But on the other hand, the stakes have become higher that he should start delivering on his promises to reveal himself, really reveal himself as Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yeah, well, the tension caused by that pressure was already evident just weeks after the Wrights moved to London, evidence of which comes from Andrea O'Hagan, who recalls a meal with Matthews, during which Matthews was outraged to find that Wright, who had been told to stay incognito following the Wired and Gizmodo affair and ahead of the signing sessions, spent $180,000 on customised BMW i8s, one of which Matthews said stands out like the dog's balls in the proverbial moonlight. Matthews also referred to the Wrights as backyard scrappers, who had suddenly found themselves in a high-stakes poker game, before adding that the pair would wind up on a plane back to Australia and probably jail if they didn't keep up their end of the bargain, i.e. to reveal Wright as Satoshi. Matthews even threatened to call off the deal, even though it would cost the companies involved some $30 million, if it turned out to be a bad decision. So now we turn to the signing sessions themselves. This all gets a bit technical, but we'll try and keep things as simple as possible. So, in terms of cryptographic proof, there are a number of things Craig Wright could have done to prove he was Satoshi Nakamoto, including moving Bitcoin from the first addresses, signing an email with Satoshi's PGP key, or having a trusted third party verify the keys in Wright's possession. For various reasons, he elected to do none of these. Arthur, could you break down exactly what Wright said he could do and what it would prove?
When you see the number of Bitcoin that is the balance of a Bitcoin address, it is connected to a public address. Behind the public address, the owner of that public address, which is Satoshi Nakamoto, he also owns the private key behind and belonging to that public address. There is a feature in that wallet that if you upload your public address in there, you type it in or you copy-paste it from a Block Explorer and you tell your Bitcoin wallet, hey, this is my address. Then this wallet will ask you, oh, can you please copy-paste or type in the private key so that we are 100% sure that we can do transactions on behalf of you from this wallet to somebody else's address. And that means that at that moment, you can also do something else with that public address inside your wallet. You can go to a feature which is called signing and verification. The screen that will come up then will ask you, well, type a message. Yeah, just a simple message. Hello, I'm Arthur van Pelt. How are you doing? Question mark. After typing in your message and you click submit, then it will create a so-called signature string. And that signature string is just, again, a crazy mix of letters and figures. But the thing what you can do at that moment, you send your public address plus the signature string to somebody else, can be on the other side of the world, but you can even post it on a public media. Is this information correct? And what you will see happen then, a public address, a message, and the signature string, those three elements together will prove to the other person who is doing the verification that, hey, the person giving me this information about that public address owns the Bitcoin on that address. And of course, the balance can at that moment be zero, but at least that person has access to and control over the public address, which came with those three elements.
Okay, so we've got these three elements that we've created. We've put a message saying to somebody else, please verify this. How would that third party go about verifying your private key ownership?
Yeah, they also open their wallet. There are also online tools to find to do the verification. It will drop those three elements in his screen in the three different fields that they should use for that. And then they do not click submit, but they click verify. And at that moment, it will tell you verification failed or verification succeeded.
Okay, and presumably then if we see verification succeeded, that's then proof that the person who sent those details genuinely owns the private key to that wallet and therefore owns the Bitcoin within that wallet.
That's it.
Brilliant. Okay.
The meaning of this signing procedure is that you send it to somebody else, preferably on the other side of the world, preferably not in the same room with you, preferably using totally different signing and verification tools as what you are using, but of course all connected to the same blockchain from Bitcoin. And what happened in those first few signings, Craig Wright was in full control.
Yeah, and we'll come to why that's important in the next episode. Now, Wright and Encrypt believed that the signing of these addresses would be the jewel in the crown of the proof package, a package that would include other evidence from Wright, the backstory from Andrew O'Hagan, and, of course, Wright himself, who purported himself to be a walking font of Bitcoin knowledge. Ironically, this wouldn't be the first time that Wright had been asked to sign Bitcoin addresses. In May 2015, the Australian Tax Office asked him to do this exact process to confirm a bunch of Bitcoin addresses he told them he owned, which would have all but ended their case against him if he could do it. For undisclosed reasons, Wright chose not to take the ATO up on their offer. Wright had a dry run at this address signing process, using Andrew O'Hagan as his guinea pig, but the author was so dumbfounded by what Wright was actually trying to prove that he had to ask him to explain exactly what he'd just seen. Even after this, O'Hagan still seems to have been unsure of the net result. Undeterred, Wright and Encrypt pushed on with the signing sessions, with plans formalised for the entire parade. This would contain three elements: the physical evidence, in the form of documents, emails and other written proofs, which would come from Wright and would link him to Satoshi Nakamoto, and two separate signing sessions, where Wright would sign these early blocks. The first session would be for some well-respected Bitcoin insiders, and the second would be to the press, with the entire thing forming an irrefutable and headline-grabbing PR coup. The two Bitcoin insiders chosen for the event were John Matonis, the founder of the Bitcoin Foundation, and Gavin Andreessen. Now, Andreessen in particular is a big part of Bitcoin's history, isn't he, Arthur?
Yeah. For those who don't know, who is Gavin Andreessen? He was the person who took over the Bitcoin project after Satoshi Nakamoto left. Satoshi Nakamoto left in December 2010. At that moment, Gavin Andreessen was already involved for quite a while, so he knew Satoshi Nakamoto pretty close. But when Satoshi Nakamoto left in December 2010, he asked Gavin Andreessen to take over the project and take, let's say, the lead, so that Satoshi Nakamoto did not have to return.
Yeah, it's pretty clear why Gavin Andreessen was particularly interested, excited to meet Satoshi Nakamoto. Now, it emerged after the event that Encrypt had also tried to rope in other members of the crypto community to take part, such as Andreas Antonopoulos, Charlie Schrem, and Zuko Wilcox O'Hearn, whose company created the cryptocurrency Zcash. All of them rejected the invitation, however, with the offer clearly leaving a bad taste. In a Twitter conversation between the trio, Wilcox O'Hearn said that he'd been approached by Encrypt and immediately smelled it and stayed away, while Antonopoulos wondered how many others they tried before they narrowed down their list of marks. Charlie Schrem said that they offered to fly me out and get schmoozed. No thanks. It's pretty clear they smelt a rat, didn't they?
Nay, but it was probably also based on the experience that he already had since the December docs with the Bart and Gizmodo story. And of course, he did not have a good reputation, and they knew that Craig Wright was surrounded by, shady stories, so to say.
Well, While they may have known about some shady stories, what they couldn't possibly have known was that Encrypt had hired two PR and strategy training companies, Milk Publicity and Outside Organization, to help give Wright media training, given that he was going to face questions over his claims. Wright seems to have been a bit embarrassed about this, however, given that he claimed in court in 2020 that he didn't remember ever having any media training for it, even after being asked to read out emails from Milk Publicity and Outside Organization in court about how badly he was doing in his mock interviews. So with Wright having been suitably trained, whether he remembered it or not, in early April, the Encrypt gang, with Andrew O'Hagan observing, assembled in London for the first session. Now, as we've already suggested, Craig Wright wasn't exactly enamoured with the prospect of what was about to happen, as he explained to the author, saying, "We're going to bring them in on reveal sessions in the next few weeks. I guess that's the way it has to be. Do I like it? No, but I haven't really been given a choice. I am between a rock and a hard place because of whoever outed me last year." Now, Arthur, setting aside the irony that Wright himself is the favourite candidate for the doxing, he's making it seem here as if the only reason the signing sessions were going ahead was because of the doxing, like they had to make up for it somehow. But the signing sessions were already in the works months before this, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. The startup of the signing sessions happened already in November, so yeah.
Now, Gavin Andresen had never heard of Craig Wright, despite him apparently being the fingers behind the keyboard that had emailed and messaged Andresen on a regular basis for years in Bitcoin's early days, eventually handing him the keys to the whole thing in 2010. So obviously, he was keen to get an understanding of who Wright was prior to their meeting in April, and the pair began an intriguing correspondence in the lead-up where Wright alluded to some incredible mistakes he had made without divulging what they were. We get a taste, however, in an email from Wright to Andresen after Andresen had said that he had never heard of Wright's multiple businesses, which were, after all, supposed to be Bitcoin-related. Wright replied, "That was part of the idea. It was a front in some ways. I have made some really stupid mistakes. The ones that matter remain hidden. The media has grabbed all of the shit and low-hanging fruit, and they have done no real investigation. Thank God for the laziness of human nature." What do you think he was referring to there?
It appears a bit that he was talking about the troubles that he went through with the ATO, and they did what that was not public information, so of course that would not be known. And on the other hand, what we know now is that those companies that he set up in Australia in those years were empty shells, only used for the tax fraud that he was executing at that moment. So of course nobody ever knew about it. It was only in the news a few times. So, of course, Gavin Andresen didn't know anything about any company that Craig has ever been running.
Well, I'm sure Craig Wright is now delighted that there are finally journalists doing more digging into his background. John Matonis was the first of the invitees to see Wright sign a message, with the exchange conducted in private, as had been the case with Andrew O'Hagan. They had a conversation, Wright signed, we don't know what he wrote, and the session was over. Matonis doesn't appear to have been too sceptical or to have asked any difficult questions of Wright, but he was prevented from publicising anything due to the embargo that was in place for everyone until May the 2nd. Arthur, do we know anything more about the Matonis signing?
Nay, we only know what Matonis wrote about it himself, and it was going online on May the 2nd, 2016. That's probably all we know.
Okay, well, let's then move straight on to the Gavin Andresen signing then, which was a different beast entirely for two reasons. Firstly, Andrew O'Hagan was there to document events, and secondly, Andresen was asked to revisit the signing during a deposition for the Kleinman versus Wright court case in June 2020. With more experience in the inner workings of Bitcoin and its encryption techniques than almost anyone else at the time, Andresen would be a tougher nut to crack. To help him decide on Wright's merits, Andresen had listed four things he expected Wright to be able to do if he was Satoshi. These were: sign a message with the same PGP key Satoshi Nakamoto used in 2010, sign a message with the keys from the earliest Bitcoin blocks, provide copies of private correspondence between Andresen and Satoshi, and have a technical conversation about Bitcoin. Now, we already know that Wright was reticent to sign using the PGP key, and we also know that he was about to sign with keys from the earliest Bitcoin blocks, which left evidence of correspondence between Andreessen and Wright and a technical conversation about Bitcoin left in order to satisfy Andreessen. As O'Hagan tells it, the pressure on Wright during this particular signing was huge, given that Gavin Andreessen was a widely respected Bitcoin developer and, in theory, the man who had taken over from Wright in 2010. Wright and Andreessen chatted for a few hours before Wright signed Block 1 with what was, to all intents and purposes, the private key belonging to Satoshi Nakamoto. Everything seemed to be going fine until Andreessen made a further request of Wright. Arthur, what was the request and why was it so important?
Gavin Andreessen brought a USB stick with him. He asked Craig to put the information, what we just talked about, the three elements, the public address, the message, and the signature string, put that in a text file, put it on the USB stick, so Gavin Andreessen could flip open his laptop, start his Electrum wallet, and copy-paste the information from his USB stick into the signature verification tool of his Electrum wallet on his laptop. In every case, that should be allowed, that should not be protested against. But Craig did not want that. He was afraid that, this is of course a pretty lame excuse if you ask me, but he was afraid that this information would be taken out from the session later on the laptop of Gavin, and then Gavin would disappear with this information and that it might leak before May the 2nd. Of course, it might have happened, but with a non-disclosure agreement, you can penalize somebody for that behavior if that ever happens.
Yeah, and we have a lovely quote from Gavin Andreessen, which comes to us from the Satoshi affair, in which he says to Wright, "I need to test it on my computer. I believe you, but if people ask me, I have to be able to say that I checked it independently. I mean, I doubt you've had the wallet preloaded on your laptop or whatever, but you know, you could have done." Wright continued to refuse to put the signature and all the other information onto Andreessen's USB key, to the point where Matthews was worried that Wright would be crucified if the situation was left as it was. Robert McGregor then came up with the idea of using a brand new laptop instead of the USB key, something that Wright eventually agreed to, despite saying that he still didn't expect to have to do this. However, armed with a fresh laptop, Wright downloaded the Electrum wallet and signed a message on block one of the Bitcoin blockchain, but only after several failed attempts that left Wright close to tears with stress. These failed attempts, it turned out, were due to Wright forgetting to add his initials, CSW, when re-entering the message on the verification screen, something that would turn out to be very important. According to McGregor, Wright broke down after this session, such was the emotional turmoil of the whole event, although quite why this session in particular proved so traumatic was something of a mystery at the time. Andreessen left after a long and exhausting day to write up his experience, including whether Wright had met his four burdens of proof or not, although no one would know the answer for another 3 weeks. With the Bitcoin crowd out of the way, the next stage in the battle was to win over the press. If Wright had been under pressure before, it seems that the inclusion of the press really kicked things up a notch. Andrew O'Hagan reported that Wright began to act oddly at this time, emailing the author at all hours with a pressing sense of anxiety building within him. O'Hagan even says that Wright appeared to be losing it as the plans to make the revelations public on May the 2nd became more concrete, comparing him to a child whose fantasy has gone too far. Now, Arthur, we know there were three press outlets covering the story in the end, but there were probably more that were invited, weren't there?
Yeah, it's very well possible. But three accepted, and pretty good names, actually, who wanted to cooperate in this. One was the BBC, which is, of course, a quality name to have on your list if you manage to convince them that you're Satoshi Nakamoto. And you come front page. Of course, it will make a good impression. The other ones were GQ and The Economist.
So three outlets accepted, with the BBC set to interview Wright on camera, while The Economist and GQ would put their interviews in print. The entire process would take place in the last week of April, with Wright also signing blocks in front of all three. Andrew O'Hagan, for one, was not convinced by this twofold signing process, calling it a compelling but anachronistic PR strategy that seemed crazily old-fashioned, given that Wright didn't actually need the theatrics to prove anything. In O'Hagan's view, all Wright needed to do was provide cryptographic proof and the headlines would write themselves, undoing the damage caused by the Wired and Gizmodo fallout. O'Hagan also admitted on the eve of the press sessions to feeling that distinctly that there was something missing and something wrong, and that he was getting worried about Wright. These press sessions took place over 2 days, with the BBC first in on day one. Rory Cathlin-Jones, the BBC's technology correspondent, would be the man to question Wright, with O'Hagan noticing that he appeared to feel the tension of the event. Cathlin-Jones watched Wright sign Bitcoin Block 9 on his laptop, as he had done for Matonis and Andreessen, and then asked him a few questions, during which Wright claimed that he had been thrust into proving his identity by mudslinging from people Wright chose not to identify. O'Hagan also noted that Wright began behaving as though the BBC man's softball questions were humiliating, and Cathlin-Jones himself openly hostile, something that no one else spotted. Arthur, yet again we see Craig Wright averse to being questioned about his signing process, and this is suggestive of something, because it's not like this is a job interview or an exam or something that Wright could fail. This is a simple 3 or 4 step cryptographic process that Wright should have been able to do in his sleep if he is Satoshi. I mean, if he's the real deal, this is basically an administrative matter, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. At this point, I always make the comparison with Charlie Lee from Litecoin. He signed the Genesis block from the Litecoin blockchain. It's effortless to do. It takes 2 minutes to set up a signature in your wallet. Then everybody all over the world can pick up that information, put it in your verification tool, and you click verify, and it is done in the next minute. This whole show, this whole theater, this whole drama around a simple signing session multiplied by, how many people are we now? Like between 5 and 10 people have been seeing these signing sessions. It's all a show. It's all a show. And he has all the time been afraid to be called out or to be caught red-handed, as they say.
Cathlin-Jones said that the BBC would be back the following day with their cameras to do the process again and film their interview, which Wright didn't take kindly to, and he took that bad mood into his meeting with Ludwig Siegeler from The Economist. Wright signed Block 9, and potentially also Block 1, although we can't be sure about that, once again on his own laptop, which, as we've already said, is a key factor in terms of the impartiality of this process. Just like Andrew O'Hagan, Siegeler was still a little unsure what that proves, to which Wright responded by saying that it proved he had all the original private keys, which completely contradicts Wright's own assertions that proof of key ownership is not proof of identity. Conversation then moved on to why Wright had chosen now to reveal himself, with Wright arguing that misrepresentation by the media was behind it, something that Andrew O'Hagan had never heard Wright offer as a reason for coming out as Satoshi. We know this to be a lie because Wright signed a contract to come out as Satoshi 6 months before the media had ever heard of him. None of the journalists or special guests were told that Wright was being paid to come out as Satoshi. They were all working under the assumption that this was a matter of personal choice, when, as we know, this couldn't be further from the truth. Andrew O'Hagan refers to this, saying that he felt it was wrong to tell journalists only half the story, allowing them to misunderstand the reason he was suddenly coming out as Satoshi. GQ writer Stuart McGurk was joined by Dr. Nicholas Courtois, a cryptology and Bitcoin expert that the magazine had brought along to quiz Wright, something Wright was clearly not expecting. The conversation about cryptographic proof soon turned into a blistering argument that almost came to blows.
We've got tens of thousands.
From single transactions?
Some of them from single
transactions. Single transactions, not brainwashed. Single transactions.
Well, most of them are
single transactions was your comment.
Well,
single transactions.
Yes,
no more bullshit.
Absolutely.
F off.
Absolutely.
F off. F off.
Absolutely possible.
F off.
I have more than 100 papers in cryptography.
Over.
And
f off.
Absolutely more qualified than
you. F off.
More qualified than you.
Okay. F off.
Arthur, this outburst is just extraordinary, isn't it? Not just because of the nature of it, but also the fact that Satoshi never swore in his communications, apart from perhaps one instance when he said bloody.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I was more curious to see if signing sessions would continue and be ended successfully with a more critical audience. But a more critical audience immediately gets into a fight with Craig Wright, and then it ends up that nothing happens and no proof is delivered at all.
Incredibly, Wright told Andrew O'Hagan that the GQ session went quite well despite the altercation, with the author noting that Wright was roundly applauded for kicking out the cryptography expert. Any sense of bonhomie evaporated, however, when the BBC came back for their interview, a session that O'Hagan says saw Wright more irate and less cooperative than he had been the day previously, which is unfathomable to think about. Things started badly with the BBC, with Kathleen Jones asking if Wright was confident that signing the blocks would prove to the world that he was Satoshi. Wright replied, again, that it proves I have the keys, adding that other things we'll be releasing will help, and that some people will believe me and some people won't, and, to tell you the truth, I don't really care. Wright then, in a nod to the email sent to Louis Kleiman in 2014, said in a response to a question from Kathleen Jones about whether he really was Satoshi, "I was the main part of it, other people helped." Wright then erupted when he was told that a second BBC interview was going to take place after the signing, shouting, "No, no, no. You see this door? I don't want to hear another word. It's here, it's my way, or I walk out this door and I don't come back, okay? I'm not doing this for f***ing PR stuff. I'm not doing this for anyone else. I don't give a f***ing shit about what people say. I'd rather not do it. One word about it and I'll never come back. No exaggeration. I will never enter this office again. I will never answer an email again. I'll never talk to another PR person in my life again. Got it?" Eventually, Wright did agree to the second interview, but the fact he used the word monkier instead of moniker to Kathleen Jones shows how flustered he was by this point. Wright signed Block 9 again for the BBC, again on his own laptop, out of view of the cameras and with only Kathleen Jones able to see. So, Arthur, we've had these three mainstream media outlets come in to assess Wright's credibility and look at his proof firsthand, but it seems pretty telling to me that they were given no advance notice of what they were going to see and how it was going to be done, meaning they had no way of researching it and preparing appropriate questions, and the one man who does have the ability to question Wright on the merits of his proof gets tarred and feathered for even suggesting something's up.
Yeah, absolutely. They are not Bitcoin experts, so they had not really any idea. And the only person who had any idea, it was an amazing interview, the part that we see on YouTube. My goodness, my goodness.
The BBC interview brought the whole signing session circus to an end, with the reporters all allowed to take away USB keys containing the signed Satoshi message with them. Wright later admitted to Andrew O'Hagan, however, that what was on those USB keys was fake, and certainly bore no relation to any of Satoshi's keys. Now, no official reason was given for this, but it doesn't really take a genius to work out why Craig Wright might have been reluctant to hand over keys that others could verify themselves, does it?
No. Certainly not. We learned from, I think, the Satoshi affair that he actually put some other stuff on it, his certificates and some other, what I think Craig called nonsense or something like that. It was the meaning of the marketing team that he would put the public information for the signature and the message and etc. on these USB sticks for everybody to see outside the room where Craig Wright was, but it ended up that Craig Wright did not do that, and none of this signature information ever came out.
Andrew O'Hagan summed up what he had seen over the prior 36 hours in The Satoshi Affair, noting that the way Wright had handled the signing sessions and the interviews, quote, made it clear how much of a danger he was to his own credibility. It was clear that Wright's attitude towards what were pretty standard questions that he should have expected, given the magnitude of his claims, had left Matthews and McGregor on a knife edge regarding the reception Wright was going to get and whether the world finally believed him. And so we come to May the 2nd, 2016, and the day the world, and Craig Wright, would find out if Satoshi Nakamoto had finally been unmasked. Now, Arthur, you uncovered a beautiful document that gives us a priceless insight into what Encrypt and the PR teams had planned for the day of the great reveal. Where did this come from?
It's on the Court Listener website, where the information about lawsuits and all the filings, the motions, the exhibits and everything can be found back. Sometimes these queries can come up with surprising results. And this was a hearing of Craig Wright. At the end of the hearing, and those hearing transcripts, they can be hundreds of pages because they type out every word they say during sometimes hours-long hearings. And you don't know that at the end the exhibits are there, then you will never find them. But by accident, I found it. And what I found was the timeline, the planning of May the 2nd, in every little detail, from hour to hour, from minute to minute, when they had lunch and when they were where. A beautiful piece of exhibit.
I mean, it's pretty much a cheat sheet for what they expected to happen on the day. It's like they had tried to plan out every single eventuality, and they even, as we'll come to, had these ready-made excuses for certain things that might crop up. It's incredible. It's just incredible what they thought was going to happen. It's worth going through this document stage by stage to finish off this piece about the signing sessions. It just encapsulates it perfectly. So at 8 a.m., the three publications, John Matonis and Craig Wright, would all post their individual pieces, with Gavin Andresen posting his a bit later at 10:30, given he was in the USA. The media team state that they will decline all interview requests initially for Craig Wright, but they will let Wright issue a prepared statement, which was this: "I firmly believe that Bitcoin and the blockchain can change the world for the better. I didn't take the decision lightly to make my identity public, and I want to be clear that I'm doing this because I care so passionately about my work and to dispel any negative myths and fears about Bitcoin and the blockchain. I cannot allow the misinformation that has been spread to impact the future of Bitcoin and the blockchain. I'm now able to build on what I have previously completed by releasing my research and academic work and help people understand just how powerful this can really be." Now, this is a far cry from the man who issued verbal threats to the BBC and to GQ. Suddenly he's a philanthropist changing the world for the better.
Yeah. And did you notice in the small letters that Craig Wright would at that moment also sign block number 9? It was supposed to be, what I presume, was supposed to be the public signing what would be presented to the outside world. That is how I interpret it. And of course, this never happened.
7:59, Craig Wright blog goes live. 7:59, Craig Wright signs block 9. Embargo lifts at 8 o'clock. So yeah, you're right. There was even more of a public reveal was supposed to happen before 8 o'clock.
Yeah. Now you see, lately, you see Craig Wright claiming that he never wanted to be revealed. But all this whole planning, everything, what happened before, his training, it was all with his full consent, really.
Yeah, definitely. So underneath that then, underneath their little plan for the first 5 minutes and then Craig Wright's little speech, how would you describe what comes next in this plan?
They knew that there were, of course, critics. It was discussed, especially in December 2015. They knew that several debunks and several critics came up around that time. And they hoped that they would be able to cover that if that same critics and probably also new critics came up.
Yeah, it seems a lot of this dates back to the Wired and Gizmodo leaks of 2015 and the criticism that came out after that. So it's clear that Craig Wright and Encrypt have just bundled all this stuff together and sent it to the media company as excuses and reasons, basically rebuffing all the arguments that were made at the time. It's certainly worth going through these to see how their arguments kind of hold up. So the first thing that they dispute is that Craig Wright was not a lecturer at Charles Sturt University, but was an unpaid adjunct lecturer. They say, "We can show payment via the staff web self-service portal and an invoice for payment by the university to Craig Wright for his services as a lecturer." this isn't an easy one to clear up. Initially, Charles Sturt were the ones who denied that Craig Wright was a lecturer there in 2015, but Andrew O'Hagan says he saw a photocopy of Wright's staff card, which he said proved he lectured there. As for the payment, given Wright's history of document tampering, until we actually see an invoice, it's impossible to tell whether this actually exists or not, and if it does, whether it's genuine. Now, Arthur, is there something you know about this one that I don't, or is it pretty much a one that we can't clear up?
Yeah, I cannot clear that up, unfortunately. But like you said, he is known for making the most outrageous forgeries of all kind. And for example, we know about a card that he made representing to be a vice president of some organization that he was volunteer for 2 years earlier. But he forged a business card from that organization and used it almost 2 years later to set up a multi-million fraud in Australia at the end of 2013, early 2014, which was also part of the tax fraud back then. So yeah, it's hard to say. I have to see it. I have to research it. But it could be that it is genuine, but it could for the same reason also be false.
Yeah, he has previous, I think we can say. So we can't rule that one in or out. Another accusation made in 2015 was that Wright claimed he already had a PhD from Charles Sturt. This document says, "The facts are that Dr. Craig Wright's PhD with CSU has been submitted and has undergone peer review, but graduation is not until December 2016. He has another doctorate, which is why he is able to use the doctor title. What Craig Wright put on his LinkedIn page was an expected graduation date. He did not say he had a second PhD. He can use the title doctor as he already has a doctorate. The thesis for his PhD has been submitted and has undergone peer review, but graduation is not until December." Now, again, this one is another difficult one to investigate because we can't take Wright's word for the sequence of events, and there's so much conflicting information out there, it makes it almost impossible to verify anything.
All I can say is that the other doctorate is also a lie. The thesis exists, but the doctor title that should have come with that thesis did not happen and did not lead to a doctorate for Mr. Wright.
That's the one, I think, where he put on LinkedIn that under the awarding body, he put guess, which just didn't clear anything up at all, which is why it makes it so difficult for us to find this out. All we do know is that Wright was awarded a PhD in philosophy in 2017 from Charles Sturt, and then 3 years later was accused of massive plagiarism over the doctoral thesis he submitted to achieve that award. But that's no surprise, is it?
No, totally it isn't. My focus is mainly in the Bitcoin world, of course, but his first Bitcoin plagiarism he already did in 2013, I think, in September, when he tried to be a Bitcoin expert and just copied the Bitcoin Wiki page and just renamed and reworded a few things and pretended to be a Bitcoin expert. It's amazing what this guy has been copying and pasting over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. So, on to the third criticism, which they say contests the speculation that Cloudcroft and Wright's other companies never owned any supercomputers. The passage says, "We can provide a letter from SGI that clearly states that they were working with Cloudcroft and built the Sucuriputo Okane, I mispronounced that, I think, Cloudcroft's first supercomputer, which ranked number 327 in the world. This letter comes from a director at SGI." Is there any truth in that one, Arthur?
None. The letter exists, but it is also a forgery that Craig Wright made himself, as far as we know. But during the Clymer versus Wright lawsuit, several ATO reports popped up where the whole supercomputer saga turned out to be a Potemkin village of nothingness. There was no supercomputer whatsoever. It were just loose software and probably some cloud things that he had here and there. ATO visited him, tried to find out what he was doing, and the files that he represented on the screen, it did not look like a supercomputer. It did not act and react as a supercomputer. And it ended up that they said, yeah, this has only been set up to deceive the ATO officers who were visiting him.
Okay, so we can pretty much strike that one as well. The final rebuttal they issue is with regard to the backdated PGP keys, which, if we remember from episode 2, had been backdated and inserted into blog posts to make it look like the blogs had been written years before they had. The PR people state that they have a report from a computer forensics company that dismisses the claim that keys were produced on a version of GNUPG that wasn't released until much later. They also have a quote from Wright which says, "If you go back to the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, hosted by the Library of Congress in the US, there are copies of all the software and web pages that show that the version of PGP did have those particular hash functions included at that date." Do you know how that one stacks up, Arthur?
No, I did not check that in detail yet. Like I said, this is pretty new for me. I only found this out a few days ago, so I did not go through it in detail. All I know is that it, indeed it has been debunked by the GNUPG version that was, as far as we know, indeed not available. So what Craig is trying here with the Wayback Machine, it's totally not true because it has been released in later days, that version of PGP. So I do not expect much from that research, to be honest.
It's worth pointing out here as well that Craig Wright and Jimmy Nguyen claimed in 2019 in the public forum that the Wayback Machine cannot be used in evidence because it can be tampered with and is not reliable. And yet here he is using it as his defense 3 years before that.
Makes no sense, right?
Another example of his contradictory mindset. So after this incredible barrage of defensiveness, we finally get an idea of what the signing session attendees actually thought of what they witnessed. The document doesn't specify what the BBC, The Economist and GQ were going to say, perhaps they didn't know yet, but they had Gavin Andresen and John Matonis' views on Wright's credentials up front, and it was good news. The first to post was Craig Wright himself, who had been asked by Encrypt to explain the block signing process so people could see how the trick had been performed, as it were, and to prove he was telling the truth. This he did in a lengthy and highly technical post, bringing in some Jean-Paul Sartre to back up his point, as he was known to do from time to time. John Matonis was in no doubt about what he had seen, stating in his piece How I Met Satoshi that during the London proof sessions, I had the opportunity to review the relevant data along three distinct lines, cryptographic, social, and technical. Based on what I witnessed, it is my firm belief that Craig Stephen Wright satisfies all three categories. The BBC posted their interview with Wright, not offering any opinion on their experience, and 2.5 hours later, Gavin Andresen published a 5-paragraph piece entitled Satoshi, in which he stated that the careful cryptographic verification of messages signed with keys that only Satoshi should possess was enough to convince him, beyond a reasonable doubt, that Craig Wright is Satoshi. So straight off the bat, everything is going brilliantly for Craig Wright. He's got two Bitcoin evangelists in the bag, and the world's media is starting to report on their assertions that Craig Wright is, after all, Satoshi Nakamoto, something everyone can check for themselves by reading Wright's blog, if they know about cryptography anyway. Wright's backers were understandably overjoyed at this point, which is evidenced by a flurry of congratulatory emails between Wright and his PR teams, in which Wright said that the strategy was all going well, while the PR people proclaimed that it was all going to plan and that they were right on course so far. That was 10:13 a.m. By midday, however, everything had started to go horribly wrong, and we'll find out how in the next episode. Arthur, thank you once again for your expert insight.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
We are really getting to the meat of this now, aren't we? This is just before the crazy is really let out of the bag.
Yeah, I can already tell you it's going to end even worse for Craig Wright as it ended up with Wired and Gizmodo.
Mm-hmm. So you can follow Arthur on Twitter at MyLegacyKit for regular updates on Craig Wright, or for more in-depth pieces on Wright and his activities, you can follow him on Medium, also at MyLegacyKit. A word of warning though, Arthur's work naturally contains spoilers, including key events that we'll be discussing later in the series, so be advised of that before you take the plunge. Thanks once again for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to episode 3 of Dr. Bitcoin, The Man Who Wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, it would really help us if you could rate the podcast and subscribe on your platform of choice. And if you want to support the podcast, there are links in the show notes for how to do that. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so via email at drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. That's drbitcoinpod. And you can follow us on Twitter at drbitcoinpod. That's at drbitcoinpod.
You've been listening to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Written by Mark Hunter, with additional material by Arthur Van Pelt. Editing and production by Mark Hunter. This has been a Contented Media production.